This is a podcast from BBC Studios. A commercial subsidiary. Of the BBC.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to the first ever episode of the BBC Earth podcast. It's a podcast all about nature. Over the series, we'll be bringing you stories about the wild and beautiful natural world. Stories from unexplored places, about some pretty amazing animals, and the people who love them. The theme for this first episode is beginnings, which I think is the perfect way to kick off a brand new podcast. And what better way to begin with stories of beginnings than in the first cold streaks of light at the dawning of a new day.
I listen to the dawn chorus in the way that I would listen to a piece of music. So sometimes I will drift through the different melodies, and then sometimes I'll tune in to a particular solo that a robin might be doing or a wren might be doing. The dawn chorus is really a audio picture of the place, of the habitat. So the dawn chorus varies from place to place. A woodland dawn chorus is very different to the dawn chorus next to the sea. I particularly like the waders dawn chorus.
Very few of us get up early enough to hear the birds sing in the dawn. And even fewer of us decide to sing back. But this woman does.
My name is Hannah Tulicki. I'm an artist, composer and performer. And a lot of my work deals with the mimesis, the imitation or emulation of the more than human world.
Earlier this year, Hannah and her little flock of performers, Lucy Duncombe and Nerea Bayo, took part in the BBC's celebration of International Dawn Chorus Day. As the birds sang, they sang back.
Why do birds sing at all? There are two main reasons. One is to attract mates, and the other is to defend their territories from rivals.
That's Andy Radford, Professor of Behavioural Ecology at the University of Bristol.
Why dawn is it's a time of day when sound might transmit better. It's often stiller at that time in the morning. Also, there's a theory that if there's a slightly heavier layer of air, a little bit above the ground, sound might bounce along effectively and transmit further compared to other times of the day. If you listen to the dawn chorus, you can absolutely hear different species starting at different times. Species that are tending to spend their time near the canopy start earlier because it gets lighter up there sooner than it does near the ground in the denser undergrowth.
So the birds use the morning to sing to each other. And some people, like Hannah, sing to the birds. But can it ever really be a two-way thing? Could we ever have a conversation?
My most successful interactions have been with ravens and with cuckoos. I was in southwest Finland, near to Tampere, maybe a couple of years ago, and I went for a walk in an old oak forest. It was in the winter, and the snow was on the ground, and I started to call a Gallic raven call into the forest. Not expecting anything to happen, but then a raven began to call back to me and flew closer and closer. It was just an incredibly magical experience. And since then, I've been calling ravens when I go into their habitat. And it really works. It's quite special to be able to have that interaction with another being. As if having a conversation, but obviously I don't know what the meaning of the conversation is.
Even if you never get up early enough to hear the dawn chorus, there's one beginning that you can't help be curious about. Our own. Where did we come from?
I guess one of the first things that we look at as anthropologists is when apes became bipedal. We used to use brain size to distinguish that, and now we know that a larger brain size came much later in human evolution than bipedalism did.
This is Dr. Jill Preetz.
As to when something is human, that's a good question. I think that paleoanthropologists would actually have some discussion as to what the definition of human is.
Jill's a professor of anthropology at Texas State University.
I'm specifically a biological anthropologist, and within that, I'm a primatologist.
You might think that paleoanthropology, the study of early humans, is all about fossils, bones, and fragments of old tools. But some paleoanthropologists, like Jill, take a different approach. She studies chimps, our closest living ancestors, in a place called Fongoli in Senegal in West Africa.
I started out studying chimpanzees in a savanna because we think that much of early human or pre-human evolution occurred in a similar type of habitat, a really dry, hot and open habitat. So I was really interested to see how apes adapt or adjust to the pressures that they have to deal with, high temperature, scarce water, because they're our closest living relative. Understanding how the chimpanzees react to these pressures can at least provide some hypotheses that we can pose to try to better understand early hominins.
Chimps are usually pretty wary of humans, but Jill spent the last 2 decades habituating the Fongoli troop, getting them used to having a little group of humans watching them quietly from the background. They act completely naturally around her and her team. So in 2016, when a BBC Natural History team wanted to find a group of chimps to film, they went straight to Jill.
Without her and her team, I just don't think that there would have been a hope of us even remotely filming this film.
That's Rosie Thomas.
As in my name is? Okay. My name is Rosie Thomas, and I was the producer-director on the chimpanzee episode of Dynasties.
Dynasties is a BBC TV series, the story of 5 different animal families struggling to keep themselves and each other alive. Rosie spent 2 years out in Fongoli, and she saw firsthand some of the behaviours that Jill studies.
They do a lot of behaviours, and this is why the scientist studies them, that are quite reminiscent of early man. You know, spear hunting, for example. They make spears and they hunt bush babies in tree holes with these spears, which no other group of chimps anywhere does.
They hunt with tools, they use water, they use caves, they're active at night. And all these things were behaviours that I didn't predict. So I knew they would be different in some ways, but I never predicted that you would see, for example, hunting with tools.
They make them out of branches on the trees and they snap them off and then they kind of peel off the ends to kind of fashion the end into a spike. Yeah, they're really quite adept at doing it. The females in particular. The females are the best, actually.
And it's not just spear hunting. They also fish for termites with specially designed pieces of twig that they chew into shape.
I've tried my hand at termite fishing, but I'm really bad at it. It's not as easy as it looks. The only time I've been successful termite fishing is if I find an old chimp tool on the termite mound and use that. Whenever I make my own, it doesn't work. The chimpanzees at Fongoli surprised me a lot. It's what makes my job pretty interesting. Another thing they do is that they're really calm around bushfires, and fires are something they have to deal with on a regular basis.
every year their territory goes up in flames. Historically, the wildfires would have been natural. These days, most of them are set by humans. Mostly, I'd say it's probably farmers clearing their land, which they're perfectly entitled to do. It's their land. For the chimps, it takes away everything. It takes away their nesting material. It takes away a lot of their food resources. It's quite an integral part to their story that they have to survive these things. From what I observed, the chimps are able to read the fires incredibly well.
I was really surprised, and my protocol is actually to stay with the chimps. If there's a wildfire around, I tell my students, you need to stay with the chimps. Don't think that you can outmaneuver the fire. We're really bad at it. And the chimps are just really calm, a lot calmer than I am around these fires.
They sort of don't really worry. It would kind of surprise me, I suppose, because I think, well, hold on a minute. There's a danger coming and you can hear it and you can smell it. But yet they're not fussed by it.
The chimps may be relaxed around the wildfires, but Rosie and her team, trying to film them, had to be a little more focused.
You spot it in the distance and you point and you go, oh my God, there's a fire over there, there's a fire over there. And then you drive like the clappers to try and get there before it burnt out. Because they burn so fast. I don't know, 50 metres in about 10 seconds. And you're just standing there going, oh, hold on a minute, and sort of running down the road with your camera, trying to keep up with it. It was extraordinarily hot. I'd say it's probably about 40 degrees during the day. And it doesn't drop much at night, I have to say. And you've got heat coming from the ground through the ash. You've got heat coming from the sky, from the sun. And then you've got this kind of wall. It's like a massive radiator on full blast right in front of your face. It's uncomfortable.
How big is it, Matt?
I mean, at the moment, it's fairly small.
So we had to wear full face masks and goggles. So you kind of got all this contraption over your face and head and stuff. And then you kind of got to pick up the kit and sort of run into these fires. And there was one instance where we found this huge fire and it was just literally a wall of smoke. And we're just getting ready and Mark raced in with the camera. And I'd sort of be kind of coming behind with the control panel, trying to like do all of the panning and tilting and focusing on the camera. And you're trying to talk to each other through comms. So you've got headsets and microphones and you're shouting at each other to try it because the noise of the fires is just epic. It's almost like white noise, but at full volume in headphones and going straight into your brain. Mark's trying to shout the instructions to me, and I'm trying to shout back. He says, oh my God, my trouser leg's on fire. And then the comms cut out. And I was just, I was like, what are you talking about? And I was thinking, oh God, I can't see him, I can't hear him. He told me his trouser's on fire, what am I going to do? And then he sort of strolled out about 3 minutes later, and he went, oh no, it's fine, I put it out. It was funny, actually. At the time we were filming the fires, I just remember thinking, God, this must be so tough for them. I don't understand how they're going to survive this when these fires are obliterating everything that they have, how they're going to make it through to the rainy season. And then we film them through the rest of the time through to the rainy season, and you sort of notice all these things that they do, that, like termites, because the termites obviously don't die in the fires, because they go underground. It's a huge source of food for that group. And it's just, you think, God, that's actually really clever. I'm always sort of slightly blown away by the cleverness of chimps and the intelligence of chimps. It's they just always find a way, and they always will find a way. It's incredible.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
You're listening to the BBC Earth podcast, where we're exploring stories of beginnings. It's hard to think of a wildfire as anything other than a force for destruction, burning up everything in its path. But fires like the ones the Fongoli chimps have to deal with can also be the precursor for another kind of new beginning. Wildfires clear away old dead foliage, open up space, and return nutrients back to the scorched soil. Once the rains finally hit Fongoli, the blackened earth is quick to transform back into lush green savanna. Sometimes what looks and feels like complete devastation can pave the way for transformation.
I was a very proud soldier. I considered myself a professional soldier. And I've tried to carry that on to civilian world, but, you know, there's a lot of obstacles out here.
That's Eric Grandin.
Yes, ma'am. I hail from West Virginia in the United States in a little community called Ovapa.
Eric spent 20 years in the United States Army.
I enlisted when I was 19.
He completed 6 tours to the Middle East and retired in 2005.
Then I kind of went on a downward spiral after leaving the uniform.
Like so many soldiers, Eric developed severe PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. In 2011, he suffered a horrific flashback, which left him in hospital, unable to fend for himself.
My oldest brother, he came to my room 2 days afterwards, and he said I looked like a wild beast. My eyes, you know, was constantly surveying the area. My wife, she told me that, she said, I've been married to a man for 25 years, yet I do not know him. And it broke my heart. They discharged me from the hospital with my wife and 9-month-old child, and there was no way I could take care of myself. I was incontinent. I couldn't comprehend English. I just basically wanted to kill myself. And I contemplated it for about 2 years. Every day, I got up and I'm like, I wonder if it's going to be the day.
But Eric's life was saved by something a little unexpected. His mentor, a man called Ed, persuaded Eric to get a couple of beehives. It's fair to say Eric didn't take to it straight away.
I put them in the box and that was the last time I'd seen him for about 2 years. I never went back in the box. I was scared. They just luckily survived on their own. Once I actually got into the hive for the first time, that's when the magic happened. You know, that's when I noticed the outside world went away. There was no intrusive thoughts, no anxiety, no depression. And we basically listen to the hive. And for me, that sound is enough to block out all the bad. You know, a lot of us have trouble sleeping. I actually have a recording myself, and I can listen to that, and it just puts me right to sleep. The military works in it as a unit. We all have the same purpose, the same goal, the same mission. There's no arguing, there's no bickering. I miss that. You know, that cohesiveness of the unit. Well, the honeybees have that. You know, they sting and they know that's it. But they do it for the colony. A month and a half later, they all wash downstream. My area, well, it's the central part of West Virginia, had a horrific flood. The water came out about 50 feet, and basically I'd found remnants of my hives about 2 miles away. Well, that was like losing everything. I mean, I had just found something that kept me on this side of the grass, and all of a sudden it was taken away from me. I guess it's like receiving a life-saving drug. You know, you start getting better and all this stuff, and all of a sudden they take the drug away.
But Eric wasn't sunk. Not quite. It turns out beekeepers, just like bees, tend to look out for one another.
It was my mentor. He made 3 phone calls. So all of a sudden, I received 20 brand new hives on a truck. And I received brand new queens from California. And he tells me, you need to go to Georgia and pick your bees up. And I drive down to Georgia in a Jeep Cherokee and put 360,000 bees in the back of the Jeep Cherokee and drive home with those. And so I was back, you know, on my high again, I guess you could say. I started receiving my therapy again. And I couldn't even explain how I felt when I found this out. I mean, just, I was in awe. I mean, people had no idea who I was, but they felt it was worthy, or I was worthy enough, I guess, to save. I hate to say it like that, but, you know, they did it without question. They did it because, you know, they're that type of people that would just give you the shirt off their back.
There was one final twist of fate for Eric and the bees. Eric and his family were on holiday when a phone call came. At 3 in the morning.
We had basically lost everything. And we brought the fire marshal in the very next morning. And he told us it was arson. My honey house, our farmhouse, there was hives still smoldering. And the bees were gone, of course. And then a couple days later, I started seeing a lot of activity. And I thought it was just robbing. You know, where other bees come and take over a hive and steal their food. But they had actually reestablished a colony. All but 2 hives flew back. It may have been a different colony from somewhere else, but I didn't ask them questions. I was just tickled to death they came back. Every time, you know, you open the box, it's different. It's a new beginning. I start over every year.
Oh, spring is, oh, absolutely the most, well, for me, my most favourite season. It is such a beautiful time of year because everything is coming back to life. All the colours back, all the wildflowers emerging,
insects,
the smell. I mean, you can really smell spring when it's here.
We've got new life.
Everything's breeding.
Everything looks fresh and clean and bright.
I love spring. I just think it's a very special time of year. My name is Lily Moffat, and this year I worked as story lead on the BBC Spring Watch series.
It's Spring Watch!
Spring Watch is a bit of a televisual institution here in the UK. When the first buds start appearing on the trees, you know that somewhere there's a BBC Natural History team, head to toe in brown oilskins, crouching quietly in some country hedgerow, ready to show the world the season unfolding. A lot of it is done with tiny remote cameras hidden away in nests and burrows. And not far from them, and only slightly less well hidden, will be Lily and her team, tucked away in the relative warmth of the truck.
We love our van, our story developers, and there's usually sort of 5 to 6 of us in there, and it isn't a massive truck, so it does get cosy in there. Some fruity language always, because it's like we invest so much energy and hope in these birds or mammals, and we can have upwards of 45 cameras, live camera feeds, coming through our truck. So we have to prioritise what cameras we think are going to show the most action. For example, we had weasels take our yellowhammer family. We had a stoat take our chaffinches. It was kind of carnage, really, in terms of predation this year. The most exciting stories that we had this year was probably Plucky. Plucky was our great tip, and we had a beautiful great tip nest which was in the bottom of a tree, in a tree hollow, and there were 5 chicks, 5 eggs that hatched. And we had been monitoring Plucky for the weeks up to the day where we thought it was going to fledge. And he was sort of, he or she, was developing rather slowly, but, you know, still being fed. And we thought, right, today's the day. Four of Plucky's siblings managed to fledge successfully, and there was just Plucky left in the nest. Of course, we're watching the cameras, but we're also hearing a lot that's going on. And for anyone who keeps up with nature and knows a lot about birds, the jay's call is sort of unmissable. It's very loud, very shrill. And the jay, of course, is from the corvid family, the crow family. And they will take anything, carrion or young birds, eggs. They'll take a lot of whatever they can get their claws on. So we were watching Plucky and we were hearing this jay and we thought, oh gosh, is it going to happen? And in this nest, we've got a really teeny tiny internal camera in the nest. So we were watching the outside view and the internal view. But then we suddenly saw the jay land on the nest from the outside. And on the internal camera, we saw the beak slowly creep into the nest and Plucky was sort of pushed to the back of the nest. I don't know, I had that music, like the horror music, the da da da, coming into my head, because this beak is massive and this little great deer is teeny tiny. It really was something out of a horror movie. I thought, oh gosh, it's gonna have him. But it didn't. The jay flew away and Plucky thought, right, that's it, I'm gone. So we watched Plucky emerge from the nest and fledge, and the last footage we've got is of a few rustling nettles. So we're hoping that Plucky made it.
We don't know what happened to Plucky. Maybe he made it, maybe he didn't. But that's nature. Every new beginning has an end, eventually. The amazing thing about the natural world is new beginnings are everywhere. Every breaking dawn, every new moon, every lush new spring. Every bud on every tree, every egg buried in the sand, every drop of rain heralds the start of something completely fresh and new. Perhaps that's one of the reasons why we're so drawn to the natural world. When our lives are full of chaos and catastrophe, sometimes it's nice to remember that the dawn always comes. There's never been a winter so cold that the spring didn't come eventually. Just like the spring, this podcast has come to its inevitable end. But also just like the spring, there's another one just around the corner. Thanks so much for listening to the first BBC Earth podcast. I'm Emily Knight, and I hope you'll be back for the next one, when we'll be bringing you more stories from the natural world, this time about isolation. Some of the stories you heard in this podcast came from the storytellers and makers of BBC Earth's latest landmark programme, Dynasties. Narrated by Sir David Attenborough, we follow the lives of five extraordinary animals, each in a heroic struggle against rivals and against the forces of nature, fighting for their own survival and for the future of their dynasties. Visit bbcearth.com/dynasties for more information on when you can catch the series in your country.